On this episode of the Naturist Living Show, Naturism and Christianity.
This episode of the Naturist Living Show is brought to you by Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park. At Bear Oaks, we offer traditional naturist values in a modern setting. Free your body, free your mind. www.bearoaks.ca.
Ah, summer's finally here. It's June, and I'm recording my podcasts now from my trailer at Bear Oaks once again, out in the sunshine. So if you're hearing birds and the wind in the background, it's not just a sound effect, it's the real thing. This episode is about naturism and, it's supposed to be about naturism and religion, but it's very much focused on naturism and Christianity. We're going to talk about general religion a little bit. But because I was able to find mostly experts in Christianity in terms of religion, that's going to be our focus for this show. But I would very much like to focus on other religions, on Muslims, on Jews, on Buddhists, on anybody else who finds that there is no conflict between their beliefs in God and religion and the fact that they are naturist. So if any of you listening out there are one of those folks or know of one, I would love to hear from you. But this show, because there are many very active Christian naturists out there writing about Christianity and naturism, this show is going to focus mostly on that aspect of naturism and religion. It all started actually with an email I got from Chris. He commented on episode number 30 of the Naturist Living Show, where I talked about the difference between ethical naturists and recreational naturists. And, I'll just read you his email, and I think he says it very well. Thank you for your podcast. I just thought I'd add my thoughts. Actually, as I write this post, I'm listening to the current episode. Very interesting. What I find interesting about this particular show was the religious aspect. Religion! Exclamation point. Yes, religion. You refer to the creed which you hold to and to the various moral aspects of shaming people over nudity. As soon as we talk about right or wrong, we enter the argument over absolutes versus subjectivism. I believe that there are absolutes in right and wrong. I just don't think that we necessarily have them right at all times, such as when we shame women into bottle versus breast for their babies in public. I am a teacher of the Bible at a small church. I therefore have the beliefs that there are definitely rights and wrongs in the world. Now, when you refer to your creed and philosophy, I find that I see what could grow into a religion. For myself, rather than adhere to a new religion, I'd rather examine myself as to whether what I am holding to is a mere tradition, though just because something is a tradition does not make it in itself wrong, or if it is just by its very nature right or wrong. This is something which I think we should always do, and I, as a believer in biblical teaching, find myself doing regularly. What you have presented is also in contrast to what some might think you would hold. Many would assume that if you are a naturist slash nudist, that you in fact do not hold to absolutes, that is to say that something is right or wrong. That is more of the approach of the pornographers. And yet what I hear from you is someone who definitely believes that there are rights and wrongs, though they may differ from what the vast majority of my congregation would believe. Actually, I'm not really sure that my parenthetical remarks would be accurate. You don't support porn, and many naturists I've talked to refer to a chaste nudity. By that, you don't support the swinger mentality, but rather a wholesome family environment. A parallel observation could be made with early Christians who were accused of all sorts of gross immoralities by their critics who did not understand them. Early Christians were accused of holding orgies and sacrificing children because people did not understand the truth of their simple private communion services, but let their prejudices run. And so it is today. Many, with the aid of suggestive internet sites, automatically assume that places such as Bear Oaks is full of wife-swapping perverts molesting their own children, all because their own minds are running away with their own perverse thoughts. And all this by people whose own forefathers were persecuted by people who assume that they knew what must be happening behind closed doors. Maybe your little podcast is opening up the doors just a small amount so the world can see morally chaste nudity is possible in an otherwise perverse world. Sorry, my note is much longer than planned. It's no problem. Actually, your notes is very well written and really made me think and was really the seed that got this whole podcast started. I'd thought about doing a podcast on religion, Christianity before, but this one really got me going. And in fact, it wasn't the first time that I'd thought about the parallels between naturism and religion. There are many elements of a movement like naturism that have religious aspects to it. In fact, last fall, in the fall of 2010, I did a talk at Wilfrid Laurier University, which happens to also be my alma mater. And I had originally met one of the students of one of the religion classes who contacted us because they were doing some papers and studies on movements that had characteristics of religion, and she thought that naturism might be one of those. And she was so intrigued that she suggested to her professor that I should come in and lecture the class, which I was very happy to. In fact, it was a lot of fun to be talking to all those young adults and who were very interested and asked lots of great questions. There was a real interest in what we were talking about. So let me quickly actually go through the points that I made about naturism and comparing it to religion, because there are many religious characteristics to naturism. We are a group of people with a common moral viewpoint. And by that I mean we all believe that, you know, the wearing of clothes and forcing people to be ashamed and embarrassed and offended by the human image is wrong. And that ties us together, not just when we're together on a beach or in a club, but in the way we live our lives. And that's one of the things I was addressing when I was talking about ethical naturists. We have our own rituals and traditions, as you find often in religion. You know, those may vary from one variant of naturism, just like it does amongst the variations of Christianity that are out there, for example. We also have rules and values about what we should do and how we should behave and how we should live under this common moral viewpoint. And again, that varies from club to club, as it probably does from church to church. And also, for a lot of people, myself included, there's an element of spirituality. You know, whether that connects you closer to your God and your religion, which I certainly feel closer to God when I'm out in nature, when I'm not wearing anything, when I am dressed the way I was made, I feel a lot closer connection and a strong sense of spirituality. And a lot of people, even if they're not religious, have described that feeling as they come to Bear Oaks to maybe relax and meditate. So there's a spiritual angle to naturism, certainly. But it's not a religion because it has no deity. Most, I think all religions by definitions have to have a deity. That's part of the basic belief that there has to be a God. It's also not based on faith. It's actually based on a very logical argument, an argument which runs counter to the emotional, psychological issues that people have with nudity. We've talked in other shows, actually several of the other shows and episodes of the Naturist Living shows about how irrational our fear of nudity, our desire to be ashamed and embarrassed by our bodies is completely irrational. It's all based on emotions and learnings and perhaps even phobias. So there's no faith necessary to be a naturist, and which is one of the reasons it does not go against established religions and can work with existing religions, because we don't have a deity and we don't have faith. That's part of a regular religion, the mainstream religions. We also don't have any sacred objects or places, although certainly there are certain books that we think are really fundamental to what we believe in and what we are. And there are certainly certain places and clubs and resorts that we hold dear. But none of that is sacred. If the tone of it changes, if it's not what we want, we just move on and find a new place. And finally, it's not a religion because there's no tax deduction. I often wished it was. I've often joked that I should turn this into a religion and Bear Oaks would be a church and I would have to pay a lot less taxes and I wouldn't have to pay property taxes, but it's not. And a few weeks ago, actually, there was also a discussion on a Canadian Anglican blog about, it was a reaction to a news story about a gentleman in Canada named Brian Colden who is fighting for his rights under the Canadian Constitution and the Canadian Bill of Rights, essentially, to have the right to be nude, that his rights under the law against nudity are being trampled upon. And in that blog posting, people were discussing about how basically anti-Christian nudity was and naturism was. And I waded in with my own comment, disagreeing with him, obviously. It quickly turned into a debate about what the Bible said. And being that I'm not a theologian, I asked Tom Pine, who you might recall from the podcast on fiction writing, episode number 6, of the Naturist Living Show. Tom has quite a bit of background and writes extensively about Christianity and naturism. So I asked him to wade into this discussion on the blog, and he did a terrific job. So I called him for this particular episode so that we could have a discussion about naturism and Christianity.
I became a Christian using the term born again Christian back when I was 13 years old. So most of my life from then on, including my time in the military and early married life, most of my married life, I lived as an evangelical conservative Christian. I say evangelical rather than fundamental because I don't consider myself a fundamentalist. There are fundamentalists, but and I won't go into any dissertation on the difference. I'm not. I'm an evangelical conservative Christian. I don't have any bones to pick with Catholics, Episcopalians. In fact, I have any number of denominations involved in this newsletter that I put out. But that's another issue. Throughout my life, I lived a pretty straight-laced life. You know, at some time in my life, I was a teetotaler. I never smoked. I believed in, fidelity in marriage to the nth degree, and et cetera, et cetera. So you might say my view might have been a little bit narrow, black and white, narrow-minded, whatever you want to call it. And perhaps some of that is true. But when I got to be 50, that was, the midlife crisis they always talk about. Some men deal with that with a 28-year-old mistress and a Corvette. In my case, I started thinking about various things in my life because I wondered, is everything that people are telling me necessarily true? I pretty much followed what elders in the church told me, and I went with what they pretty much said was copacetic, of course keeping in mind that it had to square with scripture, and I didn't see any dichotomy there, so I followed pretty much what my elders said. And to this day, I mean, I'm now 65 and I still defer to people as if they're my elders, and I realize this guy I'm deferring to, he's 15 years my junior. but anyway, at 50, I started thinking about various things, and one thing I always enjoyed in my life was good art and good photography. And there was one issue that was a bone of contention among Christians, and that was nude art. But I always thought of it as just that, art. And I often tell people I gave myself permission when I was 50. And one of the things I gave myself permission to do was to buy books that had good nude art in it, good nude photography. And I started pursuing that subject and studying the subject. And along the way, I recalled some various small interactions I had with people and the nudist community. I remember one time in the Army, everybody was going to shock. They used to call me chaplain in the Army. I wasn't, but that's what they called me. One of the guys was going to shock me, and he brought me into the tent. And it wasn't – this was in Vietnam, and it was in the mid-60s. And pornography was a lot different then. And but I thought he was – I kind of got the idea what he was trying to do. He was going to bring me in to show me a stag film or something. But instead, to my surprise, it wasn't a stag film. It was a nudist film. And although that was pretty much exploitation at the time, it was nothing more than nudists playing volleyball and just doing what nudists do without clothing. And I couldn't help but think as I watched that, you know, I know this is supposed to be wrong according to what people tell me, but – these people look like they're having a good time, and I don't see anything necessarily wrong with what they're doing. They're just naked, and they're enjoying themselves. I said, how can this be wrong? So that all played into when I got to be 50, I started investigating things like that. Well, what got me into nudism / naturism, and I'll use naturism from now on because I prefer the term, I got into photography again. I picked up my camera and started seriously taking pictures again. I did this back before I was married, but most of my married photography was snapshots. But I got into more artistic stuff because my kids were older. My youngest at the time was 19, and the other two were adults and on their own. And I decided to get back into photography more seriously, and I wanted to do figure work, you know, nude photography. Well, who did I have as a model? I had a house I lived in with this beautiful woman who I thought would acquiesce to this, and she did. My wife agreed to be my model, my wife Marilyn. And we would go to various locations, and it would be kind of like, okay, get your clothes off. Let's quick take some pictures. And then I'm worried. I'm looking over my shoulder the whole time, worried that somebody will interrupt us in the middle of where we were. Although in most of the time we were so remote that nobody ever really did. But one day I decided, why are we just going through all this cloak and dagger stuff? Let's go someplace where nobody would bother us. Now, we lived in New Jersey at the time, and we knew of the infamous G Beach on Sandy Hook, which is Gunnison Beach. One day we packed up our gear and off we went to find the infamous G Beach of Sandy Hook. So we parked the car, got out, walked down, and sure enough, we saw the signs that you usually see on nude beaches. Notice you may encounter nude sunbathers. And I said, yes, we found it. So I took Marilyn over to a site. We set up. We got our blankets spread out, put our umbrella up, and I said, okay, Marilyn, yeah, you get out of your clothes. And I got everything off except for my swimsuit, and I started taking pictures. And when I stood next to Marilyn, here she is very casual about being nude in front of other people for the first time in her life. And I'm thinking, how is she doing this? You know, this is cool. And I thought, well, it's only fair. I'm wearing shorts and she's nude, so I should join her. So I took off my shorts, and we have a picture of the two of us, our first day nude. It was kind of cool.
So at that point, are you feeling any conflict with the fact that you're a Christian and that you're nude on the beach and that you're taking nude pictures?
At that point, my first thought was, this is so cool. I can't believe I'm standing out here on a beach with other people around, and here I am without a stitch of clothing on. I thought it was the coolest thing. But at the back of my mind, I'm saying, man, I certainly hope this is not in opposition to scripture, because when I check, if I find it out, I'm going to be heartbroken. So I have to admit, I did not check too carefully the first few forays out onto the nude beach. But over the next few months, I started checking out scripture, and lo and behold, I found out that in the Bible, the only references to nudity are either casual, that it's expressly requested by God, and the only time there was a negative aspect of it was when someone did something wrong. And of course, there's always that verse that non-naturists bring up all the time about clothe the naked and feed the hungry. Well, that is more destitution rather than simple nakedness. I mean, obviously, when God told Isaiah in chapter 20 to go nude for 3 years, that was kind of, I didn't see there's anything wrong with nakedness. If there was, why would God tell Isaiah to do it?
So the one that I hear the most often from Christians who may or may not be well-versed in the Bible is that right at the beginning, in Adam and Eve, God is telling us that being nude is bad.
Well, actually, that's not the case. When Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit, and it doesn't really say it was an apple, we just think it was, they realized, well, I'll give you a quick quote here from Genesis 3, the 9th through 11th verses. It says, "The Lord God called to the man and said to him, 'Where are you?' And he said, 'I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid myself.' And God said, 'Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?'" So God's first reaction was not, "Yes, and you should dress." He just said, Who told you you were naked? The issue wasn't their nakedness. The issue, he had created them naked after all. In Genesis 2:25, it says, "And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." The issue wasn't over their nakedness. The issue was over their eating the fruit which he commanded them not to eat. When you think about it, they had one thing they couldn't do, and they blew it.
You've had a lot of these debates and discussions, and you've written extensively on that. So what would you say are the top misconceptions that people have about how both the Old and New Testament are against nudity?
Well, the first biggest misconception is that there's something wrong with nudity in the Bible, or the Bible is against it. The Bible is not. I challenge people all the time. You show me a verse in the Bible where God is unequivocally against nudity, and I will put my clothes on and never be nude again in a social context. And nobody to this day has ever been able to take me up on a challenge. One of the things, and this is the second one, is that, well, God gave skins to Adam and Eve to clothe them because he wanted them to be clothed because of their sin. And that overlooks the fact that the skins were for protection because he was driving them out of the garden and they would no longer be in this perfect climate of the garden. That's number one. Number two, they were skins, not a cloth garment. It required the killing of an animal to provide a skin to wear. And that all, the Bible is very prophetic and so on. And that foreshadowed the sacrifice that would be needed to cleanse Israel of their sins, the blood sacrifice, and later on, the sacrifice that the Lamb of God made for us all, you know, Jesus being Jesus and his sacrifice for our sins. So that's that one doesn't really hold water when you look at it carefully. Another big misconception was that when David saw Bathsheba, well, look, he saw Bathsheba, they fell into sin, and see, if she weren't naked, if he didn't see her naked, that wouldn't have happened. Well, that doesn't hold water either, because where she was visible pretty much to anybody who could see. Obviously, David saw it, so anyone else could see it. The sin, if you will, was not Bathsheba's being naked. It was David's reaction. He knew she was married. He knew that he was doing the wrong thing when he brought her to the palace, and then not only did he have an adulterous relationship with her, and you have to understand the relationship. He was the king, and she was one of his subjects. He literally had the power of life and death over her. Monarchies in that day were a lot different than monarchies are today, or later on. the king had absolute power. So when he commanded her to come to his bed, she was pretty much obeying what he told her to do. And then he tried to cover it all up by having her husband killed because there was a baby involved. And he wanted to make sure that, you know, that the husband would be the one, the father of the baby, even though he was, that the father, the husband would be considered the father. But he couldn't get the guy to be with his wife because who am I to be home with my wife when all the other soldiers in the army are out in the field? And so he engineered the man's death by putting him on the front lines, and he got killed. And so that was there was the sin. And no, in that particular passage, I point out to people, at no time did God ever criticize Bathsheba or punish Bathsheba. What she had done was not a sin. So it was all on David. He did the wrong thing. And one of the biggest problems was this was the spring. It says at the beginning of the passage, in the spring when the kings went out to war, David was back in the kingdom. What was he doing back in the kingdom? He was shimming off. He wasn't doing his duty as king. He should have been with the army. Instead, he was back at the palace, and you know what they say about idle hands. You know, the devil finds work for idle hands. And so that one doesn't hold water either. So, I mean, every time somebody brings these things up, I am able to effectively counter them. I also point out the whole passage in Isaiah where God commanded Isaiah, who was a prophet, to strip off his clothes and go naked for 3.5 years. And people say, yes, but it was to show how humiliating it was for the captives of war, because he was prophesying that Israel would be taken captive and they would be naked and barefoot with buttocks and covered to their shame. And I say, well, yeah, but Isaiah walked naked for 3.5 years among men, women, and children. If that were so horribly wrong, why would God have commanded him to do something wrong? That's one. And another one was when Saul, one time, he got caught up in the spirit, King Saul. He got caught up in the spirit and he stripped off his clothes. And the onlookers didn't say, oh, man, this guy lost it. They said, oh, is Saul now among the prophets? Now, this was a common occurrence. The prophets often got naked for whatever purpose to bring their message to the people. So there are so many times in the Bible where nudity is accepted with a yawn. It's just not a big issue. Then you go into the New, they say, well, that all changed with the New Testament. No, it didn't. Peter and the fishermen of the day fished without clothing. Maybe they wore a little Gunga Din loincloth that they show sometimes in the movies. But most likely they were naked, because clothing was a very precious commodity, especially to a poor fisherman. And it even mentions that Peter, you know, dressed when he saw the Lord. I don't know why. He dressed and then jumped in the water. Got his clothes wet. I don't know why he did that, but it indicated that he wasn't wearing clothing at the time. And I point out, too, that Jesus, at the most important times of his life, Jesus was naked. At his birth, at his circumcision, when he washed the disciples' feet, it said he took off his robe. So obvious, and wrapped a towel around him. Well, between the time he took off his robe and wrapped a towel, he was obviously seen without clothing. Didn't sound like it was much of an issue for him, because he went over and he used the towel to dry the feet of the disciples when he washed them. And at his crucifixion, the Romans stripped him bare to put him on the cross. That little loin, a little cloth you see across Jesus' loins on the crucifixes is the artist's concession to what they call modesty, when in fact Jesus was crucified nude. And it even showed it a little bit in the movie, the one that Mel Gibson did. Can't think of the name of that one. Passion. When Jesus rose from the dead, he was nude. I mean, because it indicates that he left the grave clothes behind. And I don't think that in those days they hung a robe on the inside of tombs just in case somebody decided they wanted to leave. So Jesus, and it showed him in the film, you see his naked flank as he steps out of the tomb. and Mary confused him for the gardener. And there's a lot of debate about that. But again, gardeners often would work in the nude because they wouldn't soil their clothing. They could simply rinse off and keep their clothing clean. And Mary mistook him for a gardener, probably because he, you know, not probably, because he was wearing nothing.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like there's lots of casual nudity in the Bible then.
Oh, yes. And casual nudity was common in ancient times. I mean, people basically wore robes and underwear wasn't really big. I mean, BVD hadn't been invented in those days. And people wore loose robes. And I'm sure there were so many times when families would be together that the nudity just wasn't an issue because they were so close upon one another. You know, they bathed and it wasn't an issue with families. We very often mistake, in this age of easy access to clothing, kids having their own room, bathrooms with doors and all of this, indoor plumbing and all that, we've gotten used to a standard of privacy that didn't exist hundreds of years ago. And we culturally think in terms, we think of the Bible in terms of our culture. And I argue with people all the time. I'll say, you're not arguing the Bible, you're arguing culture. Now, when you talk about modesty, I often have said to people, I talked to a Muslim girl one time and I asked her why she wore the garb, because she wore the whole hijab and burqa and all that stuff. And she said, well, we do it for modesty. And I said to her, well, I always considered modesty to be more a state of mind than a state of dress, to which she didn't have much of an argument.
Well, and in fact, there's a section in the Bible where it talks about that women should dress with modesty.
Oh, Timothy.
Timothy, yes. And, you know, you could interpret that lots of ways. It doesn't say you should dress. It just says you should dress with modesty. But it really is wearing.
Well, it also mentions braiding of hair and a great deal of ostentatious jewelry. Paul was talking to a young preacher who existed in and around Corinth, which was a very Corinth was like the Las Vegas of the day. I mean, a lot of stuff went on in Corinth that it was dedicated to pagan gods. They had the cult prostitutes, and the women who participated in that religious belief would dress very richly. Very rich clothing and very ostentatious jewelry and hair and all that. And so when Paul is advocating to Timothy that women should dress modestly, that's what he was referring to more than – he didn't say they should dress. He said they should dress modestly. And we know even in our culture, there's a way to dress modestly and there's a way to dress immodestly. And it doesn't always mean nakedness. I mean, an immodest dresser could be somebody who's just – totally inappropriately dressed for any given situation.
Yeah, and in fact, it's even being nude as a way of being nude modestly and as a way of being nude immodestly.
Oh, yes.
Even in law in Ontario, when women won the right to be top free, a bunch of strippers thought this would be a great opportunity for them to go outside of their establishment and promote their wares. They were promptly arrested and charged with committing an indecent act, which is still illegal. And that was upheld because they weren't simply nude. They were their attitude, the way they were acting and touching themselves and moving was clearly immodest and clearly, in this case, an indecent act.
Rightly so. I remember one nudist park we went to in Florida, Seminole, down in Davie, Florida. And when I walked over to the pool, there was a young woman, very attractive young woman, who was sitting completely nude on a lounge chair doing needlepoint. And I thought to myself, now there is the very picture of modesty. She wasn't doing anything she didn't even look at me at the time. She hadn't noticed I had arrived at the pool with my wife. And so she was just sitting there doing her needlepoint, and I thought, she's not doing one single thing that would be considered lewd or untoward. She's doing needlepoint. I mean, what could be more modest than that?
So there's actually a fair bit of material written about naturism and Christianity and the Bible. There's a few books that we have at Bear Oaks in the Bear Boutique. There's a lot of material online. In fact, I have this feeling that there may be actually more written about naturism, nudity, and Christianity than there is about naturism alone.
I don't know if that necessarily is true, but there certainly is recently a lot of material written about it, because I think we're starting to see more and more Christians involved in naturism when they realize that they're not doing something antithetical to their faith. And it's more like an apologetic to show that what they're doing isn't wrong, because they, of course, you get criticism as soon as you open your, as soon as you get your clothes off and the people know you're a Christian. Wow, your church finds out you go to the nude beach and there's a big issue with it. And that is a sore issue in the Christian community today. And I think that's probably what's the driving force behind so many of these articles and these magazine treatises on Christian naturism. I follow the doings. In fact, he's part of my newsletter. You get my newsletter, right?
Yes, yeah, I do.
Yeah, I'm sure you've read some of the stuff that I put in there by Jim Cunningham.
Yes, absolutely.
Whom I consider one of the, he's sort of like the, he's certainly not the Pope, but he's the cardinal, one of the cardinals of naturism. And he often says that Christians really have one of the best arguments for social nudity than anyone, because the sins of the flesh that everyone talks about have been dealt with under the blood of Christ. So therefore, they have the most rationale for social nudity. And of course, there have been sects that practice that as part of their worship, the Adamites, the Dukhobors, are a couple that I can think of. There's another group I just heard of recently. But their problem was their other beliefs were heretical. The Adamites got into, they didn't marry. They thought marriage was wrong. They believed in, back even way back then in the early 1800s, it was free love. They believed in free love and all of the same stuff that we were hearing in the 60s. And so they were going off on a tangent that was heretical, and that's why I could never ascribe to their general beliefs. But their practice of worshiping in the nude, of course, I have no problem with, because they felt that because we were the blood of Christ covered our sin, then we could return to the state of Adam and Eve and be naked.
So why is it, though, that there are so many Christians out there who don't just disagree for themselves, but feel the need to specifically attack naturists for practicing naturism?
I don't necessarily think that's just common to Christians. I think it's common to a certain type of person. I mean, you can see that in the secular world as well. Somebody's doing something, not bothering anybody, and it just crosses with somebody's thought, and next thing that person is being criticized for it. To me, it mystifies me, because even in my most black and white period of my Christianity and my orthodoxy, if you will, picketing a nudist beach or a nudist park, it just was not on my to-do list. What they did was what they did. It didn't concern me. So why go in there and be obnoxious about it? But there are people, like some pretty infamous characters we've read in the news, who feel that their mission in life is to tell people not to be nude. I don't see anywhere in what Jesus said. He told the people to go out and preach the gospel to the world. He didn't say anything about telling them to get dressed. I mean, that wasn't part of his mission. So you've got me with that one. You stumped me on that one. I have no answer for that, other than misery wants company. I mean, they may be so miserable in their lives, they just want everybody else to be as miserable as they are.
Well, I mean, I was raised as a Catholic, and we're now Anglican with my wife. And I, you know, while I believe in God, I wouldn't certainly consider myself to be deeply religious. And I certainly haven't studied the Bible to any extent. But, you know, I was raised going to in Christian schools, and so I got my dose of catechism. Catechism? How do you say it in English?
Catechism.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I got my dose of catechism, and my overall impression from Jesus was that, you know, it was not to force your will on others, but to actually be quite tolerant, and that's how you won people over. And I, never mind naturism, I'm often confused how people who say they are, you know, fundamentalist, evangelical, whatever you want to call Christians that are basically going back to the core of the values can seem so intolerant and so judgmental, when that's not at all what I've ever was taught about Jesus.
I agree. So when you go back to the New Testament, so much of the message there was very, very specific. Jesus' mission was simple. He was to come and tell people that he was the propitiation, the big biblical word. He was the substitute for the world's sin, and that he had been sent from God as God's son to take upon himself the sin of the world and to would be with him in heaven. That was his message from the beginning to the end. It was very, very simple. He did give certain things. If you look at the Lord's Prayer, it is one of the simplest prayers ever. There's not much to it. And that was by design. I mean, Jesus didn't say anything by accident. I mean, most of what he said was a quote of the Old Testament. If you look at the red part, you know, the red words in your New Testament, you'll find 80% of it is Old Testament. He's quoting the Old Testament. And his mission was very narrow. And back when the church first started, the elders of the church, their biggest prescriptions to Christians were not to eat meat dedicated to idols, and not to be involved in fornication, which that's an old word meaning illicit sex, meaning sex outside of marriage or adulterous sex. That was it. They didn't have a 99 page list of do's and don'ts. That was pretty much it. And that crossed with the Pharisaical Jews of the day, because they had hundreds of laws that they put upon the people beyond the Ten Commandments. Even that, in the Old Testament, God gave us the Ten Commandments. Pretty simple, pretty basic. And there's not one of those Ten Commandments says, don't be naked.
Right.
There's no 11th commandment that says, thou shalt not be nude, socially. This is the biggest problem. Well, another problem we have in the West is because a lot of the church leaders also brought things into the Christian argument. St. Augustine was a good one. He, before he was a saint, and that's strictly a man's designation, before he became St. Augustine, he was a libertine. He lived a pretty debauched life. And when he became a Christian, he warred within himself with his flesh. I mean, he hated his flesh, because it constantly, he felt, dragged him back into the world. And he tried to repudiate the flesh and fleshly desires to the point of self-mutilation. I mean, the man was definitely dealing with some serious issues in that regard, which to me is not correct. I mean, if you ignore the body, you're ignoring what God hasn't ignored. One of the tenets of the resurrection is that we will be given a glorified body. It didn't say we would become spiritual beings and live on a plane as little beams of light flitting about the universe. No, we would be given a body. So if God's that concerned with the body, are we trying to deny it? And that's, I think, that's the dichotomy the Christians face. They can't integrate the body into their system of belief. And if you get right down to it, that's heresy in itself. That's Gnosticism. The Gnostics believe that we would rise above the flesh and eventually repudiate it. But that's wrong. That's not scriptural. That's heretical. And the early church fathers deemed it so. They saw the incorrectness in that. That the body is not to be denied, because from now until the end of forever, Jesus will have a body. He became incarnate, just like we are. And that didn't cease when he rose from the grave. He had a different body, but he still had a body. So God obviously considers the body. Why are we trying to repudiate it? And my argument is it's what you do that's important, not what you are. That's why I never could understand people's vehemence about that. I mean, so what? You see another person's naked body. Well, what are you seeing? Exactly what you own, if you know whatever gender you are. You're not seeing anything unusual or different. You're seeing what you are without clothes. That's all. So we've got so much cultural stuff mixed in with our faith, regardless of what denomination you're in. Although some denominations are a little more laid back about it than others. Episcopalians, there's a faction of Episcopalians that mostly have no real problem with if you're a nudist, they have no problem with you being in their church. They're not going to throw you out.
So if the Christians listening right now have discovered, as you did, naturism, and they want to still be Christians and they need help to reconcile their faith with the naturism with nudity, what resources would you recommend?
Well, the best thing that a Christian can do if they're contemplating getting into social nudity, what I mean by that is with other people, not just their family or their spouse, is to first read their Bibles. Really read their Bibles and look into it with an open mind, because you're not going to find anything there that's against that. Number two, the internet is a great tool to but I caution people with the internet, because as soon as you put Christian naturism or Christian nudism or social nudity in your browser, you and I both know what happens. You get barraged with any number of porn sites, because they key on words like nude, naked, nudist, naturist. Then they send everything your way. So I caution people with that, because you can get really, really – if you're having a problem with pornography, well, you don't want to be browsing subjects like Christian nudity on the web, because you're going to get a lot of porn. If you have no problem with porn and you just – delete everything you get that's not correct, then fine. But the internet is a great tool for getting to sites that are nudist. I know of a young lady who had body image problems, and she went on the web and she put body image problems, and the first site that popped up was a nudist site. And today she is a nudist, a naturist, if you will, because of that site. And she has, and it was her way of overcoming her body issues. So they go figure, right? You can also, if you're listening to this broadcast, you can also get in touch with me, and I'll send you my newsletter, the Naked Truth Naturist newsletter. It's a monthly publication I send out free. And I also have a website that all I request is, if you want to become a member of our website, you send me a brief bio. The reason I ask for that is, Stefan, you know this as well as I do. If a person's trying to act like a nudist and they're not, there's so many things that they can say or put in an email that right away it sends up flags. And I've had a couple of people I've turned down, because I knew that they were into swinging couples and stuff like that. That was not what we're about. And I very politely said, I think you're in the wrong place. This is not what we're about. Not that my website has any a lot of photographs or anything. I do have some newsletters, an archive of newsletters that goes all the way back to the beginning, that do have photographs in the newsletters of people who gave me permission to print them. So I just didn't want people surfing on in there if they had the wrong mindset. But if you send me a brief bio to wordworker@earthlink.net, I will give you access to the website, and I will put you on the mailing list for the monthly nudes letter, as I put it.
Yeah, and we'll put a link in the show notes for the listeners, as we usually do.
And there There's a book, I'm trying to think of it. Jim Cunningham put out a book, Nudity and Christianity. It's about the size of Moby Dick. It's a good-sized book. It's a thick book, but he's got a lot of good stuff in there. And it's sort of like an anthology. And it has a lot of smaller articles. It isn't like a one big argument. It's a lot of smaller things. So you can read sections of it, and it'll give you a good idea of some of the philosophy or gymnosophy, as they put in the early days of organized naturism.
Have you heard of Paul Bunyan's book, Nakedness in the Bible?
Yes, and I've read it. It's one of the best. That's a good one. Yeah, I should have thought of that one. It's an excellent book. It's now back in print. You can get it again. At one time, when I was first looking for it, I only got a copy from a friend. I couldn't find it anywhere. He doesn't take it from a naturist viewpoint per se. He just looks at the Bible and how it dealt with nakedness. So if you want a good treatise on what the Bible actually says about nakedness, that is an excellent one. He looks at it from about three different viewpoints. I can't remember the exact approach, but he looks at, I think, verses that actually had to do with nakedness, that alluded to nakedness, or that by what was going on indicated that nakedness was part of it. So he covers it very, very, very well. And it's one of the best books, I think, on the subject.
Both books, by the way, the Paul's book and the Jim Cunningham books are available through Bear Oaks, through the Bear Boutique as well. So.
Oh, good. Do you also have another book called Growing Up Without Shame, I think it's called? Yeah, that was an excellent book. An excellent book. I read a second book by the same author. I can't think of his name now. Clark? Dennis Craig Smith. Boy, how did I get Clark out of that? I read a later book that he did, which I did not like as much. This particular one, I thought it was a great book. He wrote it with someone else. It was a dual effort, and it was a marvelous book, looking into especially the effects of nudity on children. That's one issue that just gets me furious, is the first thing that people say, well, I didn't want my children to see that.
Well, The Naked Child Growing Up Without Shame by Dennis Craig Smith is also available through the Bear Boutique. But better than that, the next show that's coming after this one is an interview with Dennis Craig Smith from California. So you'll have to listen to that one.
I'd like to check that one out, because I have a couple of bones to pick with him, but...
Another comment I received was from Matthew Neal about the pornography show I discussed, obviously the anti-pornography show, episode 27. Matthew said, I am a committed Christian and a naturist. One of the things that I want to do is represent naturism within a Christian and biblical context. I truly believe that the best path to the freedom from pornography is frank, non-sexual exposure to the human body, experienced most effectively through naturist activities. The article that I think may relate most directly to what you've talked about is my article called The Objectification of Women. And Matthew runs a blog called The Biblical Naturist, and lots of very well thought out ideas. But I was particularly interested in the argument that he made about how the covering up is actually objectification. And he makes that argument not just for Christians, but for most religions. So I also gave him a call so we could go through a lot of those thoughts and ideas on the Naturist Living Show.
So welcome, Matthew. I was really intrigued by your blog entry, and where you seem to be bringing forth the idea that covering up is actually objectification. And while you don't make it just a religious argument, you do bring that into it again. And for the folks listening out, there will be a link to that blog entry in the show notes so you can go and read it yourself. But do you want to go through that argument a bit with us right now?
Sure. I think you're talking about the one called The Objectification of Women. I had it in two parts, but the longer was definitely, and the more significant was definitely the first part. And basically what I do is go through the fact that there are religious groups of variety of faiths that insist on certain parts of the body being covered, all the way from some of the most fundamentalist or conservative Muslims who insist upon the burqa, which completely covers even the face of a woman, and then through other religious expressions, including India, where they think it's appropriate or inappropriate for a woman to leave her ankles uncovered. And I know that personally from experience, because I was there and one of the women in our party was asked to make sure she kept her ankles covered. The idea is that, well, from our perspective here, in a Christian perspective, in the West, in the United States more specifically, we look at the Muslims having to cover a woman's face and we say, that is so wrong, because there's no reason that somebody's going to lust after a woman just for seeing her face. Or we see in India, we see them that they're, we see that and we say, hey, you know, there's no reason. I mean, there's nothing sexual about a woman's ankles that we feel like have to be covered. But we find that even within the United States, in Christendom in the United States, the standard is not consistent. There are some that insist that a woman should not show any cleavage at all. You should not even be able to really tell she has physical shape, her breasts and hips and all that kind of stuff. All that stuff should be concealed. And some of those elements of Christian practice would believe that going to a beach where there's women in even one piece, normal, modest one piece bathing suits would be more than a man can handle, and he would begin to lust. Then there's other Christians who don't feel it's a problem as long as she's got a one piece bathing suit, you know, covers her breasts, covers her loins there, and covers her midriff. But the bikini, of course, is a problem. Well, you know, first of all, where do we find any of these standards in Scripture, or perhaps any of these other religious texts? I certainly don't know of the other texts, but I know in Scripture you don't find anything that specifies which part of a woman's body has to be covered. And the idea is, if somebody else covers more than what we think needs to be covered, it's pretty clear to conclude that what they are covering, they are actually objectifying. In other words, they're saying that to see that part of a woman's body is a sexual experience and will elicit a sexual response. And since we do not believe that sexual response is righteous, then we have to cover that part so that it cannot be seen and will not elicit those wrong sexual responses. The Muslims, the most conservative that require the burqa, they believe that if the woman's face is uncovered, that people will look at it, that other men will see it and lust after that woman. And in point of fact, it happens. But why does it happen? It happens because they have objectified that body part, and when it's exposed, that objectified body part then receives that, they respond to it that way. Same thing with in India. Well, we would say, cover the ankles, that's silliness. But for the Indian man who never ever sees a woman's ankle, and here comes an American walking by with her ankles exposed, oh my goodness. And what does it do? It engenders within him the response that has been expected, and that he's been told, and that he has actually literally practiced. I saw somebody's ankle. In America, you know, some people don't have any problem with cleavage showing. Some people do. You see some cleavage. What is the response to that? Well, it's all a matter of what you expect to have. What the response you expect to have to see in a certain body part is the one that you ultimately do have. And that's why it doesn't matter what body part you say must be covered in order to eliminate sexual response, you are sexually objectifying that body part. And in so doing, you are actually engendering a sexual response to that body part that you think that you're trying to prevent.
The question, of course, that comes to mind with me is, in any of those religions where so much is covered, has it eliminated lust?
Oh, I think it only engenders it, because we have put before our eyes, albeit covered, those things that we think always will elicit a sexual response. In other words, I mean, if that's what the way God made us, to that if we see a woman's breast, oh boy, that's going to create a sexual response in us. If that's the way he made us, and he doesn't want us having sexual responses towards anyone not our spouse, then it's a rather cruel thing to stick them right on a woman's chest, right there in front of us, so that anytime they're talking to us, there they are.
So are all sexual responses lust, or is there a difference?
All right, that's, I think, a completely different issue. On the one hand, we define certain parts as saying that that's going to give us a sexual response, and we need to avoid those things. And by defining them that way, we make it so it happens. But the other part of it is that we need to be careful not to assume that every expression of our sexual embodiment or every evidence of our sexual embodiment is somehow wrong. On the one hand, I do not believe God made us to automatically get sexually aroused just at the sight of a woman. On the other hand, we are sexual creatures, and we do have the plumbing all works, and we are relational, and we relate to the opposite gender and are particularly interested in, and all those sexual realities are true and good. I mean, God made that in us before the fall. He told Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply before they ever sinned. And so the sexual reality of our embodiment is a good thing and a right thing. Just because that kind of response is in evidence in our life doesn't mean that we are having an inappropriate sexual response in a given situation. I think when it comes to the term of lust, which could be an entirely new topic, entirely different topic, but I'll just briefly say this. Lust, from a biblical perspective, is not simply a desire for a woman. It really is the term that's used for lust in the Bible, in the Old Testament and New Testament. The Old Testament's the word covet, by the way. But in the New Testament, it's a word that just simply means a strong desire, but it also carries this connotation that it's a strong desire with the intent to fulfill the desire. For example, oddly enough, when Jesus met with his disciples and said, I've eagerly longed to eat this Passover with you, and it was the last one before he went to the cross. When he said, I've eagerly longed, he actually uses the word translated elsewhere, lust. He uses it twice. It's kind of a double, really, really strong desire. And it was a desire not only that he had, but that he sought and actually fulfilled. And so I think if we just say, hey, if you find a woman's figure attractive, that's lust. That is false. Because I find lots of women and people attractive in their visage and how they look, that I would never say, boy, I'd like to get her in bed with me. Or that I'm saying, hey, you know, maybe if on such and such a time, I'll get together with her and we'll go whatever. That biblical lust includes not just the desire, but also an intent to fulfill that desire. And I think we err greatly if we say anything about that is just about sexual response or or the fact that we are sexual beings, and there's evidence of that in daily life, that is somehow something that's wrong. If it's something we're feeding, if it's something we're trying to incite within ourselves, if it's something we're trying to incite within others, then there's a different problem. But hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, well, it does. But I certainly get the impression that a lot of religious leaders wouldn't agree with you. I get the impression, listening to some of them, that they believe that any sexual feeling towards anybody but your spouse is lust. Am I wrong?
I think you're right that a lot of people, most Christians, would say that. But I don't think it's biblically defensible. And I don't think it really, at the core of it, is a belief about our bodies that they are somehow more an impediment to our spiritual life than anything else. I believe that ultimately it goes back to Gnostic thinking, where the spiritual is what's significant and right and good, and that the physical is actually evil and bad. We have, in our formal theology, we have rejected Gnosticism. In its rawest form, body is evil. We don't say that in our formal theology, but we don't give the body its due place as being crafted in God's image. Such a high, high honor and such a great dignity that is encapsulated in our bodies. Our bodies are made by God to tell us something about Him. But all we can evidently see, it seems, in Christian circles is, well, you know, yeah, sex is good, it's good within marriage, and enjoy it there. But everywhere else, our bodies really seem more to inhibit our spiritual growth or to become the expressions of unrighteousness. And, you know, all this sexual stuff is, you know, that's a big part of it. You know, the Bible does tell us to flee youthful lust. Yes, it does tell us to flee fornication. Yes, but that doesn't mean that our bodies are principally temptation devices. They are really God revelation devices. And because we have let go of the image of God and almost rejected it in many cases as being having anything to do with our physical embodiment, we have demeaned our bodies to the point where they're more an impediment to our spiritual life than an aid to it. And that, I believe, at its core is Gnostic doctrine.
Why is it, though, that most this religious dogma about keeping dress seems to be more about putting the onus on the subject of the lust than the person who feels lust? In other words, if I'm told to cover up because it will cause you to have lustful feelings, why would religious leaders put that pressure and responsibility on me since I'm not the one lusting?
Okay, great question. And this goes back to one of the things you said in your piece about pornography that I, in the blog, in my response to it, that I hailed so wonderfully. And that is this: there is a lie that we believe about men, particularly, that I believe it's just a lie, but Christian leaders, pastors, it's in the secular psychology space and all that kind of stuff, everybody assumes it to be true. And that is this: that when a man sees a woman's body, he will automatically have sexual desire for that woman. He will automatically have an arousal response. He will automatically he will automatically lust after her and all that means. I believe that's a lie from the pit of hell. Now, because that assumption is made, then anytime a woman's body is exposed, as a man, guess what? I can't help myself. All of a sudden, I am having sinful responses in this situation. And it's not really my fault. It's her fault because she's got too much of her breast exposed. Now, here's the problem. The Bible never supports that at all. The Bible never tells women, make sure you cover up enough. I mean, the if somebody wants to bring up 1 Timothy 2:9, and you go back and look at that, it's not talking about specific body parts to cover. It's talking about a woman's demeanor. But anyway, that's a whole other issue. We'll go off on that one. But the Bible doesn't tell us which parts of the body that must be covered. The Bible doesn't tell men to make sure they never see any parts of a woman's body or which particular parts at all. It doesn't say that. And if we add that, we are adding a man-made rule to and lifting it, elevating it to the point where we're considering it a God-made rule. I'll tell you what God's rule is. God's rule is don't lust. That is God's rule. In the Old Testament, it's one of the Ten Commandments. Do not covet your neighbor's wife, it says. In the New Testament, Jesus said, you know, don't look at a woman with lust, because that's equivalent to adultery. You've already made the decision in your heart to do adultery if you're lusting. It's a very powerful thing that he's saying there. But God's rule is don't lust. If it's not yours, if it's not your wife, don't try to possess it for yourself. That's God's rule. And guess what? That rule, it's very easy to follow. It's not easy to try to make myself to find the woman's figure unattractive and to my eye.
Right. And I've always thought personally that it is much more righteous not to avoid temptation, but to resist temptation. Because it's easy if you are never tempted to not give in to temptation, but it's much more righteous to actually be able to deal with temptation and not fall into it.
The way I'd say that is this: real freedom from sin is not the avoidance of every opportunity to engage in that sin. The real freedom from sin is to be in the very presence of the opportunity to sin and yet still not do it and even to have no interest in it. That is real freedom from sin.
There almost seems to be more material written about Christianity and naturism than about naturism itself. There are several books that we carry in the Bear Boutique, and there are many, many websites and newsletters, as Tom referred to earlier in the podcast, that if you want to get more information about why naturism is not inconsistent, in fact, probably is consistent and reinforces Christianity, you should seek out those resources and read all about it and share in the community of Christians who are also fervent naturists. And if any of you out there are of other religions and find no inconsistency between naturism and your religion, I'd love to interview you for a podcast too, because I don't want it to be just about Christianity. Naturism is not a religion, and it's not just for Christians. And certainly here at Bear Oaks, there are Muslims as well, there are Jews, there are Wiccans, who all believe that naturism is completely consistent with their religion. So if you're one of them, please contact me. Well, that's all for this episode of the Naturist Living Show. Thank you for listening. My name is Stéphane Deschênes again, and I am your host for this podcast and the owner of Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park. You can find links to all of the items that I and my guests mention in this show on the show notes on the website at naturistliving.bearoaks.ca. Please keep sending in your comments and suggestions. I can't read them all anymore on the show. In the beginning, I used to read them all, but there are too many. But as you can see from today's show, they do drive the types of shows that I do, and they do give me inspiration. So I do really appreciate getting them. The show's email address is naturistliving@bearoaks.ca. That's B-A-R-E, of course. and that's .ca because we are in Canada. Coming up on the next episode of the Naturist Living Show, we interview Dennis Gregg Smith, the author of the book Growing Up Without Shame, which was also known at one point as The Naked Child. So join us again in about a month for that episode of the Naturist Living Show.
This episode of the Naturist Living Show was brought to you by Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park, traditional naturist values in a modern setting. Traditional values means that naturism is more than just taking your clothes off. It is a life philosophy with physical, psychological, environmental, social, and moral benefits. Bear Oaks Family Naturist Park strives to promote those naturist values in a modern setting that provides the amenities and services that our members and visitors expect. Free your body, free your mind. Learn more at www.bearoaks.ca.